Welcome once again to our program, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. Our guest again is Ron Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High School in Bible History. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the streets. Ron, we're up to the 19th century modernist Protestantism, and Ron, our discussion of realism and idealism completes our discussion of the so-called Age of Reason, our Enlightenment. So let's go on to the 19th century. What are the main features of this century with respect to biblical scholarship?
I have always looked upon the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment as the Age of Unreason or Darkening, and not in every respect, the 18th century was an excessive emphasis on reason and the intellect, whereas the 19th century was an excessive emphasis on emotion and the will. Historians have called the 19th century the Romantic period, or the Age of Romance. In part, it was a revolt against the calculating intellectualism and rationalism of the Enlightenment, as well as against aristocratic social and political norms. Romanticism affected almost all fields of endeavor, including philosophy, religion, and especially art, music, and literature. Instead of reason and the intellect, the movement stressed strong emotional experience and the appreciation of the arts, placing emphasis on such emotions as fear and horror and awe, while, as one scholar has said, quote, experiencing the sublimity of untamed nature and the qualities that make it picturesque, end of quote. Russell Shaw, author of many books and formerly information director of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, United States Catholic Conference, and also of the Knights of Columbus, I think that's what he's doing now, writes that, quote, beginning in the late 18th century and continuing through the century that followed, the epistemological revolution launched by Descartes and Kant merged with developments in archaeology, history, and biblical study to produce a radical shift in the thinking of some theologians. Among other things, the historical value of the Gospels and the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, came under attack, end of quote. One could say that the 19th century saw the beginning of the critical movement in biblical scholarship that we're going to be looking at in the next few sessions, several sessions, actually.
All right. So let's help us now. What do you mean by the critical movement?
By critical movement, I mean the application of modern scientific methodology to the study of the Bible. Now, we could easily spend a whole session just talking about what does that mean, scientific methodology, but we won't do that. We did do that in our Reasons to Believe, our series on Catholic apologetics. But modern biblical scholars think that they are applying this scientific method, the same method that's used in physics and chemistry and biology and all that kind of thing, to biblical scholarship. To some extent that might be true, but I think there are a lot of differences, and we'll try to point some of those out as we go along in our next few sessions. But Philip Trower, a Catholic English historian, writes in his book, Turmoil and Truth, The Historical Roots of the Modern Crisis in the Catholic Church, that, quote, although forerunners like the 17th century French oratorian priest Richard or Ricard Simon and the 18th century French physician Jean Astruc were Catholics, we can take as the movement's starting point the publication of the Wolfenbüttel Fragments, 1774 to 1778, by the German Lutheran dramatist and writer Lessing. The fragments were actually extracts from an unpublished manuscript by the rationalist scholar Rumerus, which Lessing pretended he had found in the Royal Hanoverian Library at Wolfenbüttel, end of quote. Now, recall that a few sessions ago when discussing biblical interpretation, during the 17th century, we pointed out that the most that most historians considered Richard Simon, or Richard Simon, as we pronounced him there, the English pronunciation, to be the father of modern biblical criticism. And by Astruc, Towers referring to Jean Astruc, who was a famous French professor of medicine at Montpellier and Paris, at the universities in Paris, in France. And he was known for having written the first great treatise on syphilis and venereal diseases as a doctor, and was also known for publishing anonymously a small book declaring that, contrary to the claims of Hobbes and Spinoza, both of whom we looked at too, the Pentateuch was composed by Moses. Thomas Hobbes and Baruch Spinoza, you might recall, had developed long lists of inconsistencies and contradictions that they thought they saw in the Bible, especially in the Pentateuch, and also in the Gospels, and from these argued that Moses couldn't have written the entire five books. But using techniques similar to those then being used in textual criticism of the secular classics, Astruc developed a theory of the composition of the Pentateuch that anticipated the documentary hypothesis of Wellhausen that we examined in an earlier session. We've looked at every one of these people at some time or the other. Now, by Lessing, Trauer means Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, an 18th century German philosopher who is considered by many historians to be, quote, the most outstanding representative of the Enlightenment era, end of quote. He argued for freedom of thought or in religious matters and argued against the belief in revelation and the holding on to a literal interpretation of the Bible. One source has said that, quote, as a child of the Enlightenment, he trusted in a Christianity of reason, which oriented itself by the spirit of religion. He believed that human reason, initiated by criticism and dissent, would develop, even without help, by divine revelation, end of quote. So it's just sort of a little rundown of some of the key biblical scholars that we're beginning to see who are affected by these philosophers that we spent, seven or eight sessions on, people like Descartes, Hume, and Kant, and John Locke, and others.
So you're talking about a cross-pollinization,
yes,
from the philosophers to the biblical scholars.
Yes.
Well, you also mentioned Ramaris. Who was he? I never heard of him.
Well, Hermann Samuel Ramaris was a German philosopher of the Enlightenment who is remembered for his deism, which, according to one source, is the doctrine that human reason can arrive at a knowledge of God and ethics from a study of nature and our own internal reality, thus eliminating any need for religion based on revelation. I mean, the Catholic Church always taught, that we could know a lot about God and about his attributes and about, proper behavior by, studying God's creation. But it also, of course, ultimately believes that because of our fallen human nature and the limitations of our intellect and our weaknesses of our will, because,
We needed revelation.
We need revelation, yes. And revelation, of course, is found where? Well, it's found in the Bible and in tradition. And as we have said in earlier sessions, deism is the religion that God designed and created the universe and all that's in it, and then stepped back and had no concern for its operation. Many of these philosophers that we talked about in the 18th century were deist. Very few of them were actually atheists.
Okay.
They were at least deist.
But for all practical purposes, God had nothing to do with the world.
Once it was set up, he just stepped back and let it go.
A ball thrown out into space.
So you can see what's going. Anybody who's holding this kind of view, you can see what's going to happen to miracles and prophecies, because you see that would be an interference with the laws that God had set up in the beginning.
Sure.
And God just simply wouldn't do that. Naturally, with such a view, Ramaris denied the possibility of miracles and prophecies. I've read that some scholars credit him with being the initiator of the investigation of the historical Jesus also. We're going to spend a lot
of time. Which is a whole movement.
And we're going to be spending probably a good 10 sessions just looking at that whole movement.
Okay.
Because this view considered Jesus just a simple religious teacher rather than the divine person of traditional doctrine. And we'll have a lot to say about the debate over the historical Jesus in later sessions. Ramaris took his initial inspiration from the philosopher Christian Wolff, who was a German rationalist and considered to be the most eminent German philosopher between Leibniz and Kant. And according to one source, his goal was, quote, to base theological truths on evidence of mathematical certitude, end of quote. And after Reimers, the most dominant scripture scholars were Protestants, mainly Lutheran Germans. So the ones I've been speaking of, Ricard Simon and Reimers, these were Catholic scripture scholars, but there really wasn't any Catholic scripture scholars of any real significance until toward the end of the 19th century, and unfortunately, most of them were not very good ones. They were modernists, which were even both two of them especially were condemned by the church. People like Alfred Loisy and George Tyrell.
Did they both leave the church, Loisy and Tyrell?
Yes.
Okay. Well, who were the main German scripture scholars of the early 19th century?
Before we go into this question, I would like to look at another German philosopher, which we didn't talk about earlier, mainly because we were looking at 18th century philosophers. But there's at least one or two other philosophers in the 19th century, and we'll only look at one, and this is George Friedrich Wilhelm Hegel. He was a dominant figure in idealistic philosophy during the 19th century, who carried out Kant's subjectivism to its logical conclusions by denying the existence of the noumena, or the existence of things in themselves outside the mind, and in its place substituted some fuzzy notion of spirit-mind as the sole reality. It was kind of a fallback on Plato, I suppose, to some extent, but he proposed that all of reality is the outworking of this spirit-mind, or Geist in German. He said that history is the objectification of spirit, by which he meant spirit-mind, or God. It is working itself out in the historical process, and as such, history carries its own meaning. This is why I say that Hegel was pretty fuzzy. But unfortunately, he had a tremendous influence on biblical scholars, as we'll see as we go along in several sessions. From this, he concluded that there is a continual upward progress in history. History is undergoing a continual cultural and rational, I'm quoting here now, although not biological evolution, being pushed and pulled, forcing culture upward toward its final form by means of the dialectic, end of quote. According to one scholar, spirit becomes conscious of itself in man. Spirit develops to ever higher forms by a dialectical process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, which we'll explain.
Which is the idea of dialectic.
It's a dialectical process. Anybody goes to college, you can't get through college without studying this dialectical process.
Okay.
I remember even as a freshman having at least two or three classes that year where we came across Hegel's dialectical process. Primarily, of course, that was as it was applied, of course, to Karl Marx and his dialectical materialism. Well, Hegel saw historical evolution in terms, as one scholar has said, quote, of a pendulum swinging between opposites, thesis and antithesis.
Okay.
These are the opposites, which resolved themselves in a synthesis, in a position that was higher than either of the opposites. The synthesis then became a new thesis in the upward pull of the historical process, end of quote. Another way of putting this is ideas are the ultimate reality, and in history, different sets of ideas clash with one another. They're at opposite ends. The first set of ideas is the thesis, and the new set of ideas that emerges to conflict it or confront it is the antithesis or the antithesis. This the clash results in a synthesis in which the best ideas from each set of ideas is merged or synthesized into a new improved set of ideas. And once the new set of ideas have emerged, it becomes a thesis awaiting to be confronted by a new set of ideas called the antithesis. In other words, it goes on and on and on and on and on.
This is an ongoing purification.
Yes, and
it's always going upward.
It's always going upward as the world becomes improved.
Okay.
It's actually moving toward this spirit world kind of thing, supposedly. This dialectic continues in a progressive social evolutionary process throughout history. And this is why Hegel's system has been called dialectical idealism. In other words, it's in the realm of ideals that are clashing with each other and synthesizing and in human progress. Then our scholar, a scholar gives us an example. Val Hegel saw this dialectic working itself out in his philosophy of history. He says that, quote, the original thesis was the despotism of the ancient period. The antithesis to the despotism was seen as the democracy of ancient Greece. The higher synthesis of those opposing forces was understood as aristocracy. Aristocracy, in turn, became the new thesis, which was opposed by monarchy, end of quote. And I might add that monarchy was later challenged by liberal democracy, as you go on and on. Well, we have a week-long unit in my John Paul II Catholic High School apologetics class where we examine Hegel's philosophy and Marx's attempt to correct it with his dialectical materialism. In other words, Hegel's is dialectical idealism. Marx believed, because Hegel believed that ultimate reality were ideas. Marx, on the other hand, thought that Hegel's methodology was okay, his dialectic was okay, but he thought that ultimate reality was material. He didn't believe in this ideal world outside there, that everything was material, so he set Hegel on his feet. I think that's how Marx put it, and he develops this whole dialectical materialism. He converted Hegel's evolutionary idealism to an evolutionary materialism, which one scholar says explains, quote, the progress of human society through the clash of labor and capital as man advanced toward the goals of the classless society, end of quote.
Let me just throw in here to show how important what we're talking about is. Communism almost took over the world with Karl Marx's idea that dialectical materialism, that there is nothing, religion is the dope of the people and not the hope of the people, but these ideas are dragon's teeth sown in the human mind that produce such things as communism and all sorts of despots and tyranny. So we're back again to the idea that ideas have tremendous consequences for all of us.
Yes, Marx referred to his system as scientific socialism. In other words, it was applying science, you know, to understand the historical processes of the dialectic, materialistic dialectic. And this is why the Marxist, the communist, always believed that their classless society and that whole system that Marx had predicted based upon this model was inevitable, that it was all scientific, you know. And as you'll see later on, the whole system, when we talk about Strauss, for example, one of the top biblical scholars of the mid-19th century, he was extremely influenced by Hegel's ideas, and so that's why we're looking at Hegel briefly right now.
Well, remind me again, we have Marx's dialectical materialism, and we have Hegel's dialectic, what was the word?
Idealism. Believing that, you know, ideas are the ultimate reality, while on the other hand, Marx believed that material things, matter, was ultimate reality.
Okay.
Well, of Hegel's dialectical idealism, one scholar has said, quote, whereas philosophy had traditionally been occupied with the concept of being, that's in realist philosophy, of course, mm-hmm. the idea of being, Hegel substituted the process of becoming. Because all of history was seen in the process of the objectification of spirit and human beings were a part of the historical process, all human knowledge was said to be absolute spirit, God, that is, thinking through human minds, end of quote. On this subject, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy states, quote, the peculiarity of the Hegel's form of idealism on this account lies in his idea that the mind of God becomes actual only by its particularization in the minds of his finite creatures. Thus, in our consciousness of God, we somehow serve to realize his own self-consciousness and thereby his own perfection. End of quote. Well, although Hegel's philosophy is a bit fuzzy, and believe me, very, very fuzzy, even some great philosophers have tried to master him, or some great scientists have thought, well, maybe we can use Hegel's philosophy to develop a philosophy of life and a philosophy of science. They gave up usually pretty quickly because a lot of his ideas were so fuzzy. But nonetheless, had a tremendous influence. As you just said a while ago, at one time, probably half the people of the world lived under a system dominated by people who think this way, in this dialectical, materialistic way. But it seems to me that the more obscure or abstruse a person's ideas, like Hegel's, for example, the more some people think that they are geniuses. I recall back when I was in college in the 60s, the late 50s and on into the 60s, and then on into graduate school into the early 70s, and then I was a college teacher for many years. I used to see these gurus around campus, usually high on marijuana or something or the other, and people would sit around in circles and all high on something or another, and they'd be pontificating, they'd be philosophizing, they'd be coming out with all kinds of words of what they thought were wisdom, and everybody sitting around the group, hey man, hey heavy, that's wonderful, when absolutely what they were really doing is just, it was gibberish. I had a friend who went through a bad marriage and a situation, and they got a divorce, and he started drinking excessively and got a girlfriend who was on drugs, and he started getting into drugs, and he'd get a little high, and he'd think that he was just an absolute genius when he would, when actually all he was doing is just saying gibberish. Well, of course, I don't think that was necessarily true with Hegel, but on the other hand, I think a lot of his ideas were pretty fuzzy.
Actually, these guys, maybe in their deep thinking, are somewhat close to geniuses, but they certainly get off the track. And that's where we get into so many serious things, like, well, the killing, the murdering of millions of people under communism. Well, if Hegel's ideas are so fuzzy, then why did he have such a large and lasting impact on history?
One writer has commented in this regard that, quote, Hegel cast his long shadow over the entire 19th century, giving it an optimistic cast which dogmatically asserted the progress in history and the perfectibility of humanity, end of quote. In other words, it was a positive, upbeat kind of thing. As the dialectic worked itself out of ideas, that it was getting each synthesis got a little higher, and like you said, a purification and what have you as we go through history. Then he quotes the eminent Protestant theologian Karl Barth as saying, quote, it was precisely when it, that is the 19th century, was utterly ruled and completely ruled by Hegel that the New Age best understood itself. And it was then, at all events, that it best knew what it wanted. Hegel held sway until the catastrophe of 1914, World War I. His philosophy of history gave the structure adopted by the emerging schools of biblical criticism, as well as the mental cast of the entire century, end of quote. In other words, people remained optimistic until World War I. And World War I, of course, just totally destroyed the world's optimism, especially, of course, Europe and the United States.
It was so brutal and so horrible and so destructive.
I don't think there's ever been such an insane war fought in the history of the world as was World War One, and the terrible loss of life and limb that was incurred because of that and the stupidity of it. I wouldn't have mentioned Hegel at all, except that his evolutionary philosophy had such an important influence on 19th century biblical scholars and theologians. The modern idea that religious doctrine should evolve in response to changing conditions finds its roots in Hegel's dialectical idealism. This nicely complements Kant's philosophical idealism that things in themselves can't be known, including God's revelation as found in the Holy Bible. So you take these two, Hegel and Kant, put them together, both of them had a tremendous influence on biblical scholarship, especially in the beginning Protestant biblical scholarship in Germany, mostly Lutherans. But then, of course, by the time you get to the end of the 19th century, you're even finding some Catholic biblical scholars, and not just the modernists that were influenced by Hegel's evolving ideas Immanuel Kant.
Well, pardon me just a second, but there is a great deal of truth in that one idea produces a criticism of that, and it sort of purifies it, and then we get a synthesis, and there's real truth there.
Sure there is. Sure there is.
But obviously, World War I showed that it's just not an inevitable process of improvement, because
sure.
It doesn't take into account the woundedness of human nature.
And with a lot of these systems, although there might be some good in them, there's also a lot of bad.
Right.
You know, the devil always slips in 1% error with 99% truth, and that's the way he operates.
All right. Well, we finished with Hegel. Let's go back to the main Protestant German scripture scholars of the early 19th century. We're still covering the 19th century.
Well, one of the most prominent was Gottfried Eichhorn, a Lutheran professor of Oriental languages at the University of Jena and subsequently Göttingen. Philip Trier, in his Turmoil on Truth, tells us that after he published his introduction to the Old Testament during the years 1780 and 1783, and his introduction to the New Testament in 1804 to 1812, the movement from then on was dominated by scholars whose conclusions about the time and the way the Bible books were written were influenced as much by philosophical assumptions and cultural prejudices as by concrete evidence, end of quote. He illustrates this point by saying that, quote, the principal assumption was that supernatural phenomena like miracles and prophecies are impossible, and therefore a large part of the Bible must be folklore. They also intended to see people in the past as necessarily inferior, uninterested in objective truth and incapable of transmitting facts accurately. While regarding priests as by nature deceitful and only interested in the maintenance of their collective authority, evidence that the art of writing was practiced by the Hebrews at least by the time of the Exodus and of the capacity of non-literate peoples to orally transmit religious traditions faithfully over long periods of time was either downplayed or ignored. These assumptions had in most cases already been made before they set to work. End of quote. So Eichhorn was one of the first of these German Lutheran professors in the 1810s and 20s and through there that's going to have such a tremendous impact on biblical scholarship, a negative impact, I might add.
Okay, well, our time has come to a close, Ron. Thanks for your hard work, and to our radio listening audience, may God bless you always and in all ways.